and welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasure found within his pages. And now, on to the class. And good morning, and welcome to class. As I was telling some of you as we're coming in, as I was researching this, I realized that I've got to call T.C. Christensen, that I grew up close by to, and my dad was his school teacher, because there's a movie that needs to be made out of some of the events here. And it's an absolute crime that it hasn't been, because it's such a compelling story. And if you like history, this is fascinating. But one of the things about this is that from a gospel standpoint, you kind of see what's driving all of this. All right. So yeah. Oh my gosh. This is so good. I thought I knew stuff, and it turns out the more I researched, the more I realized how little I really knew. This is great stuff. Okay. All right. So let's back up. This isn't an exact picture of 10 years in the valley, but it gives you some idea. It's near the turn of the century before they finished the temple. So Brigham Young had always said, if you'll give me 10 years with the saints in isolation, I can dig in deep enough, the devil will never dig us out. It came close, and fairly prophetic. So for the first 10 years in the valley, they are pretty isolated, other than the gold rushers coming through, like in 49. But they keep experiencing crop failures. Whether it was the heat or those darn crickets that kept showing up, or whether it was trying to settle St. George and the Virgin River would just wash out everything in St. George. They just kept having a lot of crop failures. They also had a lot of immigrants that were coming from Europe, especially England and Denmark, Norway. And they were pouring in, and they were trying to figure out where to put everybody. And remember back then is that then they would say, and now we're going to settle an area. So we're going to go settle San Pete. And we're going down to San Pete. We need a blacksmith. We need a school teacher. They put together a community. They would call them on a mission to go settle whatever, Delta to Uli, to Ella. And just, it would be Tula, yeah. Just send them out, Vernal, Delta. And the thing is just self-contained before it goes. And then again, like we talked about, you're going to send out a stake president who will be also serving as what? County commissioner. You're going to send out the bishop who's also going to be serving as the mayor. You're going to send out a school superintendent, who's also the Sunday school president, you know, and you were just, it was a self-contained unit ready to go, and then just go out there and settle it. Yeah?
I'm a land speculator here, but if they hadn't had pestilence and bad weather and all of that kind of stuff, there would have been hundreds of thousands of other people trying to settle that land.
Yeah. And up to this point, they hadn't. So
they didn't have competition, and the reason they didn't have competition was because for that decade, the land wasn't that,
isn't that great?
Favorable.
I know. You know, and in fact, remember that we've got Samuel Brannan ship that rather than come across the plains, these guys are gonna sail around the Horn and come in from San Francisco, experience the gold rush, do all that, and meet Brigham Young halfway across Wyoming and go, California's awesome. You guys ought to come to California. And they're like, nah, everybody else is going to California. We won't have kind of the isolation that we need to do this.
This might be a topic for, I don't even know if it's true, but there's a place in Las Vegas. I've been in Las Vegas. There's a place in Vegas where in the 1860s, the Mormons were the first settlers in Las
Vegas. Of Vegas, yeah. And San Bernardino. And
was Centennial Bay, what is now that?
I'm not sure about that. That's a really good question. I don't know. Yeah, yeah, and I will pay $100. I'll pay $100 for the first bushel of corn grown in this valley. Yeah, yeah. So it really was blossoming like a rose. But you also had a growing Gentile presence that was starting to show up. People were making their way through here. Not many, but some. So what happens next is kind of interesting. This gives you some idea of how that was viewed in the, this is about 1852. I don't know if you can see it, but here's the Capitol, and you have these two, religious liberty guaranteed, but can we allow these reptiles to crawl over us? And you have the Mormon church crawling on this side, and you got Roman Catholicism crawling on this side. Yeah. Yeah, and it, boy, I don't know, religious tolerance, you know, we're not sure about this one. What can you actually tolerate? So there was this sense we're trying to expand westward, and now the Mormons are occupying this big chunk, right? Halfway, you know, three quarters of the way to California. What are we going to do with these guys? And it was right about this time, 1852, is when the church officially said, yeah, okay, yes, we are doing polygamy. And we're doing this. And that, then... And 1852 is also the birth of the Republican Party, built on the twin barbarism, attacking the twin barbarism of slavery and polygamy. Yeah. So there's a lot going on there, and the animosity is growing during that stretch. Okay.
Is that a loggerhead turtle?
I think it is. It's certainly a snapping turtle, isn't it? So... Anyway, so you get that sense. So in the middle of all of this, now what happens is, and I almost did a whole class on this one. Oh my goodness. Put it together. You've got the church is kind of being attacked. The people are being attacked. And the presidency of the church is all New Englanders with Puritan backgrounds. So you can almost guess what is going to happen when they're being pushed and you've got Puritan New Englanders. What are we going to do about this? By 1856, they'd been there almost 10 years, and they were so busy planting crops, building houses, settling their farms. They weren't really that religious at this point. They were too busy a lot of times on Sunday trying to make sure they're irrigating their crops to be able to go to a long sacrament meeting. So they were just kind of not doing well spiritually. Where do you think tithing is at this point? Yeah, so not a lot is happening. So here's what we're going to do. So from 1856 to 1857, just ahead of the war, they're going to start sending out what they call ward missionaries. There might be little difference. This is going to sound harsh, but there might be a little difference between the ward missionaries and the Gestapo. Because the ward missionaries were going into every war. Yes. Yeah. Now, they're going to do another one about 20 years later. But this is the first version of it, and it's run by Jedediah Grant under Brigham Young's direction. But they're going to go into places like Kaysville, and what they're going to do is the ward missionary's job is to go into every home with a long catechism. It's about 20, 25 questions, and I'm going to drill you on everything. You know, are you keeping the... Are any adultery in the home? Any stealing? Are you paying your tithing? Are you painting your barn? You know, are you raising your kids right? And they're just going, this is like a temple recommend on steroids. But with this caveat, if I find out you're doing some of this stuff, you might want to find another place to live. Because we think the crop failures and maybe the working on Sunday.
We're being punished because of you.
That's right. So if we're going to clear this thing out here, kind of like what they were doing in Israel, saying, well, it's the unrighteous in our midst that's causing God's punishment against us. So if we're going to be safe here, you might need to leave. And it's like the Danites in Far West all over again. People are actually being driven out. And if you're not being driven out of town, you're at least being driven outside the church, and now you're antagonistic coming back, which is usually what happens when you use heavy-handed, top-down attacks on people. Okay. Well, but under calling. In other words, the ward missionaries were called to drill down. They thought they did, and they did. Oh, really? I hadn't heard that. I know it was. So here's what to do. So we're going to start off. Not only are we going door by door, we're actually going to have a big Reformation meeting. And Brigham Young said, we're going to preach with pitchforks, tines down. We're getting them. Okay, so then what's going to happen is that we're going to have this big meeting, and at the end of the meeting, I'm going to take the bishopric, and we're going right out to the baptismal font, and we're baptizing you guys again. Right after them, we're going to baptize everybody else. We're all being rebaptized and recommitted, and there were thousands. And like in one I was reading, they baptized the bishopric first, and then 300 people right after that. So it was just stirred up. And so everybody at that point is really kind of doubling down. Now, the problem with this, in the middle of all this, they're going, you know what else might be corrupting this? You guys are running that dance hall in Salt Lake. And young men and young women are coming and dancing on Saturday nights. Well, that's going away. That's a problem. You know, get rid of the dance. And you guys have been running the theater. Shakespeare's a problem, you know, so on and on. So it's like, we're just going to double down on everything and just shut everything down. And it's going to get very, very austere. And there's a whole series other things we want to talk about, but there was, I found a whole series of letters between Joseph F. Smith in Hawaii and some of his friends in Utah. There's like, we don't get any dances anymore, and it's awful. And this is, you know, everybody's being accused of adultery, and it's just awful, okay? And in the middle of all of this, how do we know who the really righteous people are? They're usually the ones living polygamy. So what's another way to prove that you might be more righteous? Pick up another wife. So, and now, by the way, about 3 years later, the amount of divorces will rise in Utah. But during this period of Reformation, they're trying to find a way to prove I am more righteous and I'm okay. Don't drive me out of here. Okay? That's the Reformation. That sound fun? Ooh. Okay.
Were there places where it was more fanatical than others? Like you said,
up
front. Oh, it's up there. Yeah, in fact, it's funny. They said, Jedediah Grant says he went to Kaysville and they had this big Reformation thing. Okay, then he goes up to Bountiful and Centerville. I don't know why he's hitting Davis County first, but he does. Goes to Centerville and Bountiful, and then and he comes back and goes, they're not ready for this yet. So apparently Bountiful was a little more heathen and just wasn't accepting the gospel. So then he goes back down to Kaysville and more down towards Ogden, because they're getting it. These guys over, you know, we've always known growing up in Layton that we were better than Bountiful Centerville. But that's another story. Came out in football. We always knew who is more righteous. Okay. So the ward missionaries are going a little crazy here. They're, like I say, they're mass rebaptisms. And this is all happening in the spring, is the fall of 1856, coming into the spring of 1857. Okay? Now, in the middle of all of that then, so think about that edginess that is just on its way through all of the little colonies here. At that point, Brigham Young is the judge, or is the governor, but the because it's a territory of the United States, they're going to send non-Mormon judges, like for the Supreme Court and things like that. They're federally appointed judges as they are now. Okay. Now, Dee, if you're a judge, and I'm going to point you to the federal bench, and you're in New York, where would you like to be? In New York or Philadelphia or Boston? If you're a really cruddy judge, where are you going to get sent? It's like going out to Siberia. We're going to send you out to Timbuktu. So let's just say that Utah was not a plum assignment for, and that the really good, well-connected, great judges weren't going to get, are getting the plum assignments, and the really cruddy judges are getting the bad assignments. Yes. So we're going to send you out in the middle of the Mormons to go do this. And so they're coming with a bad attitude. So they send out Drummond. And Drummond's interesting because he leaves a family behind in the eastern states, and he brings with him his prostitute girlfriend, who sits on the bench with him a lot while he's judging. Okay?
Well, maybe that's because she couldn't find any other business in town.
It may be, exactly. Yeah. So what else can she do? So he's sitting there. Now, imagine the Reformation hitting prostitute girlfriend on the bench. Okay, you see the little clash about to hit here? Well, it do. Okay. And what happens here is that, oh, and then on top of that, then Drummond has we know a couple of things. One happened in, I think, Mapleton or Springville? In Springville, where he has a complaint against somebody. They don't respond well, and he sends a couple of ruffians to beat him up. So Drummond is doing all of this stuff, okay? And then, and you can guess how members of the church were responding to all this. Not good. So they are, and Brigham Young is really upset about this foul stuff going on in his city, especially in the middle of a Reformation, okay? So they really start pushing back big time, okay? And in fact, to the point that they run him out of town. So Drummond is run out of town in March of 1857, and he goes down to Las Vegas, and like has happened so many other times in church history, if you're going to accuse somebody of adultery and all kinds of things, the first thing they've got to do in this society is protect their honor. So the best way to protect your honor is to attack your attackers. Okay? So John C. Bennett did the same thing. What's his name in Ohio that wrote the book? Anyway, so he's down in Las Vegas and then in L.A., claiming that the Mormons are in rebellion. Well, they're in rebellion against him, but nobody's obeying the law. Brigham Young's in charge, and he's just throwing out all kinds of charges. He's firing things off to Buchanan and to Washington in isolation to say, yeah, this is really out of control. We ought to do something about this. Now, one other, they're getting, but then, now they get a second witness, and this is This is from a guy, a Judge Stiles, that's already there. Judge Stiles has a buddy of his who lost the mail contract. The country had set up a mail contract to run the postal service running from Independence to Salt Lake. And the low bid on this actually comes from Brigham Young. And Brigham Young forms a company called the XY Company, and it's going to be riders that'll go from Independence to Salt Lake and do it in 20 days. It's like the early Pony Express. And they are, so they're firing across the country, and Brigham Young has the thing. So you can actually see they're starting from Independence over here, and they're going to ride like crazy up here, all the way up through South Pass, down through Echo Canyon, down Immigration Canyon into Salt Lake, and they'll do it in 20 days. Pretty cool, okay? Now, so these guys are riding back and forth. That started in January. Well, part of what happens here is that as they're riding back and forth, and we got Orrin Porter Rockwell, who's one of the riders, bringing the, he starts hearing some rumors as he passes through Fort Kearney, and then he hears some more rumors at Fort Laramie, that President Buchanan has made some decisions here. And that is that he's ordered now that Utah is in full out rebellion and Brigham Young is not obeying anything, and they're doing all, he orders a full third of the standing army. Remember, this is pre-Civil War, so they haven't built up the army in big. So 2,500 men is a third of the standing army to go from Fort Laramie here and begin to march on Utah. Okay? They've got to quell this rebellion. And so Elder Abraham Smoot, who's passing through, and Orrin Porter Rockwell find out that this army is suddenly on its way and they're en route. So then they keep on riding. They're gonna arrive on July 24th, 1857. Okay? And Brigham Young is having a party at Immigration Canyon celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the arrival of the Saints into the valley. Okay, they're partying, okay? And in the middle of this party, they're having a good time. Here comes Porter Rockwell. And he goes straight into the party. He grabs Brigham Young. Come here a minute. There's an army on its way. And here's what we're hearing. We pass them. There's long rows of this. They got wagon trains behind them. And Brigham Young will do several things. One, Brigham Young's going to say, let's finish the party. Let's not immediately disrupt everybody. And then, after the party started over, then he gathers everybody. And this is kind of Brigham Young's language. Basically, he says, no way in hell is this going to happen. There's not one chance. There is no, you know, and he's just like, he's on fire. Okay. Later in the afternoon, Brigham Young will have another meeting with a smaller group, and he'll say, in the morning I spoke like Brigham. Now I need to speak like the prophet. What are we going to do? How are we going to do this? Okay. So, but here's his speech. That was awesome. Liars have reported that this people has committed treason, and upon their misrepresentation, the president has ordered out troops to assist in officering the territory. We have transgressed no law, neither do we intend to do so. But as for any nation coming to destroy this people, God Almighty being my helper, it shall not be. And where there is a patriot whose blood would not burn within his veins, listen to this language, whose heart would not beat for freedom, who would not stand as a band of humble worshipers of the Lord and Savior of mankind, possessed to stand, if driven to the extreme? What patriot wouldn't rise up and defend our people? Okay, this ain't gonna happen. Okay, remember, they're only 10 years out of Nauvoo and the battles of Nauvoo and everything they've been through. Okay, so basically what's gonna happen is we're gonna go on war footing in Salt Lake. And that army is out there marching towards us. We know they're out there somewhere. Now, I think it's interesting. Now, ahead of this, and I think this happens the first part of September, one outrider that will arrive sooner rather than later is Captain Van Fleet. He is the quartermaster for the U.S. Army. And he's coming out to say to Brigham Young, yeah, there's an army coming, and they've been ordered to come here and install a new governor. I need to know where I can quarter the horses, where I can get logs to build cabins for barracks, where we can feed the animals and the cattle. I need to make arrangements for the army that's coming. Where can I put those?
San Diego.
Yeah. Well, here's the crazy part. Here's the crazy part. Brigham Young actually says, I've got a spot. We're glad to have, this will be okay. I don't mind giving up the governorship. That's okay. In fact, we got some people that will donate logs and land. That will be, we'll work with you on this. And they're actually thinking down by Point of the Mountain, where we have a spot down there that I think is outside the valley that will work very, very well. Okay. That's what he's saying on one side. Now, the other thing is he says, but tell you what, while you're here, I want you to visit with some of the people, and we're going to hold a meeting in the Bowery. The Bowery was the temporary tabernacle on Temple Square, and it was just like a wooden enclosure. We're going to invite everybody here, and I'm speaking. A few others are speaking. We'd love to have you come as our guest to come hear us talk. And he says, "Oh, this is lovely." This is really good. Come, yes, 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 yes. Okay, so this is his writing. In the course of my conversation with the governor and influential men of the territory, I told them plainly and frankly what I conceived would be the result of their present course if you guys are really looking to fight this. I told them that they might prevail against a small military force now approaching Utah by getting through the narrow defiles, meaning Echo Canyon. They come through South Pass, Echo Canyon, come down the backside, and then down Immigration Canyon. Narrow defiles and rugged passes of the mountains this year, but the next season, the United States government would send troops sufficient to overcome all opposition. Okay? This is actually some of the fortifications up on top of the hill. Anybody been through Echo Canyon? Yeah, what does it look like?
You got cliffs on both sides.
Yeah, very high up with lots of rocks and stuff like that. So they're piling up rocks along the top there. We're just going to camp out up there, and then we'll just toss rocks on you. Okay? As it's coming through. It'll work very well. Okay? Because they've actually reactivated the Nauvoo Legion. So they're calling people into, and they're training and marching and stuff like that. The answer to this was invariably the same when he bring this up. Brigham Young and others, we are aware that such will be the case. But when those troops arrive, they will find Utah a desert. Every house will be burned to the ground, every tree cut down, every field laid waste. We have 3 years' provisions on hand, which we will cash and then take to the mountains and bid defiance to all the powers of the government. We'll go guerrilla.
It worked really well for the Native Americans.
It did. And it's worked well in Afghanistan, and it's worked in a lot of places. We're just going to go, our resistance will be, if we can't beat them, we will head into the mountains and we will attack you from the mountains. Okay? Now, part of what he's wondering is this just Brigham Young spouting off here? I attended their services on Sunday. And in the course of a sermon delivered by Elder John Taylor, he referred to the approach of the troops and declared that they would not enter the territory. He then referred to the probability of an all-powering force being sent against them and desired all present who would apply the torch to their buildings, cut down their trees, and lay waste to their fields, and to hold up their hands. Every hand in the audience, numbering over 4,000 persons, was raised at the same moment. During my stay in the city, I visited several families, and all with whom I were thrown looked in the present movement of the troops towards the territory as the commencement of another religious persecution, and expressed as fixed determination to sustain Governor Young in any measure he might adopt. You can attack people. Think about what's happened often in the Middle East. You can attack people based government to government. When you're attacking religious belief, now that religious belief will go to the core and you'll fight forever on that. And that's what he says. They're framing this. They see this not just as an attempt to change out the governor. They see this as religious persecution. And they got a history. They've been through this before. I don't doubt them. Okay? So, but I imagine, think about if you're one of the people in the audience. It's one thing on a Sunday afternoon to sit and raise your hand, but you finally got your house built. You finally got some trees growing, your fruit trees are starting to bloom and stuff like that, and you're saying, and I'm willing to cut it all down and burn my house down rather than have the government come through and take it over. We did that in Nauvoo. We walked away from our houses in Nauvoo. We'll do it here. Yeah, that's true. And so you get to that point, and I think that's just a level. And the other thing, too, imagine the fear. You know, if you live through Nauvoo, if you live through, for some of them, as we're going to find out, some in Cedar City live through Hans Mill. So they've got a history here, okay? So you just see this resistance kicking in, okay? Now, I thought this was interesting. Here he is. General Harney is in charge of the army that's on his way. He's on his way, and then Albert Sidney Johnson, originally from Texas, will take over about halfway across Wyoming. But when the army was ordered to Utah, the command was given to W.S. Harney, who was at the time in charge of Fort Leavenworth. Captain Van Fleet then goes back to the army, calls on him after his visit in Utah. The captain informed General Harney of the attitude of the Mormon people and the conditions as they existed in the territory. I've talked to him. I've been there. I've seen it. I see what they've got in mind. And Harney's answer is, I am ordered there, and I will winter in the valley or in hell. Which he actually did. Hell. He winters in hell because that. As we'll talk about, he gets stuck at burned out Fort Bridger in the middle of a winter, just 1 year removed from the handcarts. You go get the same kind of storms coming through Fort Bridger after it's been burned down, and they're out in the middle of, they're exposed. And now, if you are, just keep in mind, if you're this army and you're stranded in the middle of the winter in Wyoming, how happy are you with the Mormons? It's just getting worse and worse and worse, and they're getting angrier and angrier and colder. So he does. Well, they will, because they got held up. Okay, yeah, hold on here. So. Okay, so maybe one of my favorite quotes here of all the entire semester is this. So Lot Smith is given the locksmith, kind of like Orrin Porter Rockwell, has I don't know what you'd call it, celebrity status, a mythical status. It's like J. Golden Kimball has mythical status, and we can attribute a lot of things to these people. Lot Smith is kind of on that level because he's given charge of the guerrillas, whose job is to meet the army somewhere out there and find ways to slow them down. So they will do a variety of things. If they see that the cattle are, so there's two things. There's the army coming, and then there's the supply trains coming from behind. So they'll go out in front of the supply trains and burn the prairie in front of it so the cattle don't have any place to eat. They, if they're going to cross a river that has bridges on it, they will destroy the bridges. They'll tear up roads. They'll throw big logs in the middle of the, I mean, they're just, our job is to just make this as difficult as possible to get to Utah. So they are very creative out there on the plains before they're even getting to the mountains. How are we going to do this? How do we do this? Well, two little incidents that just made me laugh. One I've heard before. At one point, again, they will find one of the supply trains, and they will come riding down out of the hills and hold the wagon train up. Okay, scatter the cattle, which they start scattering cattle a lot. But then you've got the supply train. After capturing the army supply train and scattering the cattle, the captain of the train pleaded, "For God's sake, don't burn the wagons." I told him, "It's for his sake that I am going to burn the wagons." Oh, okay. And then they burnt the wagons. Okay. And then they leave. Okay. But this is my favorite quote. At one point, they again captured a large amount of government supplies. Lot Smith's journal. "We fell back on Fort Supply and eating the beef we had borrowed," eating the beef they had borrowed, "and sampling some half-cooked government beans." "As this experiment developed, as never before conceived in my imagination, the enormous pressure of the human stomach is capable of sustaining without damage came very near developing the necessity of someone else to write this sketch." Oh, the enormous pressure on the human stomach is capable of sustaining without damage came very near developing the necessity of someone else to write this. The beans nearly killed us.
Resolve of the army?
Sort of did. Yeah, but they've got to slow them down. Because we're trying to make preparations in the valley, and we're really hoping that there might be a chance for some negotiation or cooler heads or something, which that's at the diplomacy level. On the ground, they're just getting angrier and angrier and hungrier and hungrier. And as they go along here, it's getting colder and colder. As anybody who's been through Wyoming in the fall knows how bad that can really be. Okay, so they're doing that. They're doing their business. So what they're hoping for is that will slow things up. Okay, so that said, this is where I think the miracle occurred. Yeah, are you just stretching your hand there? In this class, that'll get you called on. Okay.
Wonder what that's like.
Oh.
Got up to Colorado to get a high paying job in the oil field. All summer in Colorado. Got the first of October, he got laid off. I heard there was more coming up. Doing up to Rock Springs in there 1 month.
Oh, yeah. That'd be a long month.
And he was as mad as anybody I had ever met. I'm disgusted with Wyoming and heading back to California.
Oh, Rock Springs. Oh, my goodness. And the wind is just constant coming across there. Okay. So enter the miracle. Here's Colonel Thomas Kane. Now Thomas Kane had met members of the church in Massachusetts and had been favorably impressed by them. It's Thomas Kane that helped arrange for the Mormon Battalion. It was when Joseph writes to the brethren in Bernheisel, I think, on the East Coast, say, we need some help to pay for getting the wagon trains from Nauvoo into the valley. And Thomas Kane becomes aware, and Thomas Kane goes to the army, goes to the government, and he's the one that arranges the idea of a Mormon battalion that will be made up of 500 troops to fight in the Mexican War, and they can then use the wages from these 500 men to pay for the wagon train west. That's his idea. But he will then ride, he'll take the train as far as he can, but then he will go through Nauvoo, and he gets through Nauvoo in 1846, and he's on his way to winter quarters with the news, and he will go through Nauvoo with all the abandoned houses, and the mob will show him the temple and stuff like that, and he's just heartbroken because he still passes the families of the battalion boys camped on the west side of the Mississippi. He saw those camps, and he's just heartbroken with what he's seen. And then he goes to spend time with the brethren and really kind of falls in love with the saints. So while at Council Bluffs, Colonel Kane became gravely ill for several weeks with a fever. We think maybe tuberculosis, which he will fight a long time. Was gently nursed back to health by his new friends. This is one of those things that I think is remarkable. On September 7th, 1846, Patriarch John Smith gives him a blessing that Thomas Kane treasured all of his life, a blessing that was fulfilled every whit. Among other things, this remarkable blessing declared, "Inasmuch as thou hast had it in thy heart to know the interest of the children of men, the Lord thy God is pleased with thine exertions. He has given his angels charge over thee," boy, I'll say, "to guarantee in all times of danger, to deliver thee out of trouble, and defend thee from all thine enemies. Not a hair of thy head shall ever fall to the hand of an enemy." That really gets tested, I'll tell you that in a sec. "For thou art called to do a great work on the earth, and thou shalt be blessed in all thy undertakings. Thy name shall be had in honorable remembrance among the saints in all generations." Okay? And when we get done, see how correct it says. And in some ways, our class today is kind of partial fulfillment of that blessing, because I think we need to remember Thomas Kane. Okay? What is it that he does? Well, he's going to meet with, aware that what's about to happen and knowing the anger and upset on the part of the army, that they're somewhere stranded now. They couldn't get any farther, so they have to actually decide to winter on burned out Fort Bridger that the Mormons had burnt down without their cattle and just what little bit they've got. So they're just out there starving. And he knows this is November. Come spring, as soon as the snow breaks and the pass is clear, these guys are coming in with a vengeance, and they're hot. So he goes to Buchanan, because he's well known. On first of all in November, then he's going to go back and they're kind of rebuffed a little bit. He wants to negotiate things. He meets with him November 28th, 1857, and Buchanan says, "If you know Brigham Young and you can find a way to negotiate peace, please do it. By the way, tell Brigham Young I've now seen kind of that this was turned out to be an error." Remember, at this point, they're already calling the Utah expedition Buchanan's blunder. Okay? He knows he's messed up. This is not going well. And the expense at this moment to have to keep trying to resupply this army out there is just killing them. So he really, tell Brigham Young I'm sorry. Tell Brigham Young I've made a mistake. Okay. Now, here's the problem. And so, yes, go. December 28th. Thomas Kane's in Washington. Brigham Young, and then the army's in the middle, and Brigham Young's out there in Utah. And this is December, and they've got about 90 days before the things melt. How's he going to do this? Very, very quickly. He then goes to New York. He sets sail to Panama. Yeah. He's going to set sail to Panama. He's then going to, but then there's no Panama Canal yet. So back then, if you're going to sail to Panama, you've got to then travel overland over the isthmus. Now, we've been to the Panama Canal, and we've been on some of the rivers that are there near the canal. That's dense forest. That's rainforest down there. It is dense and it's thick. He is then going to cross over, and it will take him a few days to get from this side of the isthmus over to the Atlantic or to the Pacific side there. Okay, at which point he will then catch a clipper ship in Panama, and then he's gonna sail quickly as fast as he can to get to San Francisco. So he arrives in San Francisco, but now what he's going to do, he's going to hop in a wagon, and he's going to take a wagon train down to San Bernardino. Still winter. You're not going to try and cross over what is now Donner's Pass. That's bad news. He's got to go south. So he's going to go down to San Bernardino. He's then going to go from San Bernardino down to Las Vegas. And then he's going to ride in another wagon from Las Vegas to Salt Lake City, and he's going to arrive on the 25th of February, 1858. Picture that thing. Isn't that amazing? Within 60 days. Remember, it's 20 days to go from Fort Leavenworth to Salt Lake Valley. He does that entire trip in 20 days. 60 days. That is crazy. Now remember, so he's going to arrive on February 25th. The army is sitting over there in Wyoming. And they're just waiting for this thaw to come. He's going to meet with Brigham Young. He's going to say, okay, Buchanan figured this out. He apologizes. Brigham Young says, I'm grateful for that. He says, and Brigham Young says, by the way, I'm willing to give up the governorship. I'm busy enough being president of the church. If somebody else wants to be governor, great. He says, yeah, Governor Cummings is with the army. He'll be your replacement. Great. I'm happy to turn it over to, we just don't want bloodshed. If we can solve this amicably, we'll do it. Great. Glad to hear it. Now the army needs to know. So he's pretty ill at this point. You imagine the trip down to Panama, across the isthmus, sail up to San Francisco, all the way down to San Bernardino and Las Vegas, and then make it up to Salt Lake. He's not doing well. And I think he still has tuberculosis from winter quarters.
And he's doing the worst thing for tuberculosis, which is being
human. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So he convinces Brigham Young. The President Buchanan sees the error. Great. Now go tell the army. All right. Then he's got to travel to Fort Bridger. So after all of that extensive trip down there, spent a few days with Brigham Young, try and catch his breath, get something to eat. Now the clock is still running. I've got to get to the army.
Did they give him beef?
Yeah, they might have given him beef and beans. Whatever you do, don't eat the beans. Okay, yeah. Now, he says, so he's got a couple of Mormon escorts with him. And he says, if the Mormons are with me, it's going to look like maybe we're up to something. I need to go the last stretch alone. So they stop outside of Fort Bridger, and the last few miles, Thomas Kane will go in by himself. Okay. Oh, he's then shot at and arrested. because General Johnston had ordered the shots. And so then, in pure gentleman fashion, he says, "I'm an emissary from Buchanan, and you were shooting at me? I must have satisfaction. There must be a duel." Yes. So he challenges Johnston to a duel. Now, as it turns out, Governor Cummings is close by, and he goes, "Forget Johnston, let's you and I talk." "Okay, I will go do that." And they, and it says they really ignored Johnston, who, by the way, will die in the Civil War at Antietam, I think. Okay. Anyway, so he meets with Governor Cummings. He says to Governor Cummings, he's willing to have you come be governor. That's fine. They're not gonna fight you on this. They're willing to do this. It's not what you think. Okay. Well, good. Okay. So then he and Cummings are going to travel back to Salt Lake. So again, think about Thomas Kane, everywhere he's gone, and then out, and now back. Now we got to go back South Pass, down Echo Canyon, and look at the fortifications overhead in Echo Canyon, and drop down into Immigration Canyon, down into Salt Lake, meet with Brigham Young. Brigham Young turns over the governorship. It's all good. Great. Glad to hear it. And we're going to send a runner back to the army and say, there's no battle here. Have Van Fleet. Van Fleet knows where he's going to be able to camp the people. All right, great. So now what do you do? The army is then going to pass. Here's the deal. The army will then, here's the rules. We're going to let you pass through. But if the army stops, if one man gets off his horse, if it looks like you have any intention of staying in the valley, we will start burning. So they marched down the middle of the street, and I know my pioneer grandfather was one of those standing next to a house with a torch. So they could see as there are people standing there with torches ready to go. Okay. The other thing that they're going to do, they're going to do a couple of things. They're going to send everybody north of Point of the Mountain, down to Utah County. 30,000 saints will temporarily go down to Utah County. So they're going to do that. And the other thing that they're going to do, and this is one of those helpful little moments, they actually say, we don't want them to see that we're building a temple, so they bury the temple site. So as they're coming through, as they're coming down, probably down what is now State Street, they see a plowed field. And so there was no idea even that there was a temple there. Now, that turned out to be fortuitous. Why? Why was that fortuitous?
Where's Utah County?
South of Point of the Mountain, so Provo.
Okay, how far is that compared to where?
40 miles.
Out the entire town.
Everybody, Logan, Ogden, Salt Lake, everybody's going south.
They replaced the rubble stone foundation.
When they uncovered, when the army comes through and they clear out the dirt to go back to building the temple, there's big cracks in the foundation stones because they'd used sandstone. So part of what took them a little longer to build the temple is they then had to remove the sandstone foundational stones and say, okay, now let's go up to the mountains and bring down granite. And so those granite stones that they have spent the last few years shoring up and digging underneath them were actually placed after the army had come through. So it actually turned out to be, if they hadn't done that, they might have tried to build the temple on top of it and then it would have cracked. So it actually turned out well. Okay, so they march all the way through. There are some apocryphal stories that there were a couple of officers who had actually served with the Mormon Battalion, knew the Mormon Battalion boys, that came down the street with their hat on their heart. Kind of a salute to the Mormon Battalion. Anyway, so then they're going to go down to what's now Point of the Mountain and establish Fort not Williams. It's after the Secretary of War at that moment. I can't remember who it is. Anyway, they will establish. In other words, and that means the camp followers. That means kind of the prostitutes and everybody that follows. Floyd. Camp Floyd. Should remember that from the Civil War.
So what's the tactical or strategic advantage in the men with the torches actually torching?
They just didn't want to give the army any aid. You're not going to be able to stay in our houses like you did in Nauvoo.
Johnson would have just said, well, let's all stop for a while and mill around and let them burn their town down and then we'll leave.
You would think. But at this point, they're under orders by Cummings to say, do what they say, march all the way through. Don't stop, straight south, go to this fort we're building. That's right. As Texans, Salt Lake's always north. Yeah, that's true. You always went down to Salt Lake. That's right. Okay. So, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And also, that burning your stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of a scorcher. Everything else, because they were then going to burn gardens. They were going to burn, cut down trees. We're going to leave it a wasteland if you guys are going to come in. Remember, like at Nauvoo, if you ever go to Brigham Young's house in Nauvoo, they'll show you the area back there where his wife buried her china. You know, she went out. We're leaving for Utah. And she dug it. She took her fine china, put down there and buried it. Okay, I'm not going to let you have any of this. Okay. So, well, one other problem here with all of this. So problem solved, right? Well, no. Brigham Young, when he knows the army is coming, and this is just information that we've now gotten within just the last couple of years. You're getting the latest information from Rick Turley. Brigham Young meets with the Paiutes, and he says, if the army comes to this valley, they will kill us both. We can't, and he's saying to the Native Americans, we can't have that happen. So they coordinate cattle raids to emphasize that Utah is still dangerous and needs Mormon settlements to keep the routes to the coast safe. And we know that there were four such raids in September 1857, where immigrant trains or whatever would be coming along, and the Indians would show up out of nowhere and scatter the cattle, but they were under strict instructions, don't shed any blood, just scatter the cattle. So it looks like it's still pretty Wild West-ish, and you're going to need our settlements to keep things safe, keep the Indians under control. Okay. Well, whenever you think of that policy, there's one that goes terribly wrong, one of the cattle raids. One raid is on the Francher Party, and they're coming out of Arkansas. And they happen to be coming through during July, at the height of all of this, and they're going down into southern Utah because they know there's a big grassy field just west of Cedar City, west and south just a little bit, and just north of St. George, and called Mountain Meadows, and it is. It's a really nice. I've been to Mountain Meadows, and I've walked. Mountain Meadows. So the idea is to scatter the flock. Well, they did what a lot of wagon trains would do. They circle the wagons and they pull the cattle inside. So the wagon train has circled up here with what looks like Indians shooting at them, but it turns out that it's actually white settlers. It's actually Mormons that are shooting at them. Okay. Well, they send two runners, they send two boys to try and get to Cedar City and let them know the Indians have us under attack. As the boys are coming back through, well, they as they break through past the skirmish line, they look around and go, oh no, these are white guys. There's hardly any Indians here. This is white guys. And they turn around to run back, and somebody shoots one of the boys. Okay? So that means that the other boy is able to make it back to the train, and he goes, it's the Mormons. The Mormons are the ones holding us down here. And the militia there, under the direction on the ground of John D. Lee, says, oh my gosh, they know it's us. So he goes back to William Daines and others, who's the state president, and he says, the wagon train knows that it's Mormons that shot and killed this kid. If we let them go, they're going to go down to California, they're going to raise an army against us, and now we will have an army coming from the north and an army coming from the south. And then he says, we need to use them up, meaning we need to kill them. That's what they did. There were 120 in the Iron County Militia debates the approaching U.S. Army, feels the Francher Party will go down to California, raise an army to attack them, and then they will do another thing. They will send a runner to Salt Lake. Go ask Brigham Young what we need to do. Well, the runner from Brigham Young, who says, leave him alone, let him go, arrives the day late. He comes on September 12th, and the massacre is on the 11th. On 9/11, they decide to use them up, and over 120 are killed execution style. 17 small children are spared. Most of the small children are young enough, they're infants, they're really small, generally younger than about 8. People in the area, Jacob Hamlin helps, and they're kind of placed with families down there to raise them, okay? The bodies are left, and everybody kind of goes home and doesn't say anything. John D. Lee will go up and report to Brigham Young that the Indians did it. There was a party coming through. They were all killed, a horrible massacre, and the Indians did it. And it'll take Brigham Young 2 years. It's about 1859 when he really starts to realize, with everything else going on, that what happened down there was the Mormon militia. It wasn't Indians. But they get blamed for a couple of years. There's a bunch of other salacious things that are thrown against the Francher Party. There were Missourians with them, and they had a gun that was used to kill Joseph Smith. And they were poisoning wells, and young boys died. Interesting, when Rick Turley and Barbara Jones Brown wrote the second book, and I've read a number of books on this, one of the charges was near Fillmore there was a boy that was killed because they had poisoned a well. Okay, well, what Turley did is church historian, he'd worked out of the historian's office forever, and the church asked him to write this book. They actually discovered, they went down to Fillmore and they found the boy's headstone. They found his grave, this boy that was supposedly poisoned by the Francher Party. Okay, and it's sometimes been said that historians know where all the bodies are buried. This time they really did know where the body was buried. And they got permission from the family, who actually turned out to be a cousin of Rick Turley, to exhume the body. So they actually exhume the body in Fillmore and have an independent group come in and evaluate, do an autopsy on that body, and it was determined that it was anthrax, that it was just naturally occurring anthrax from some of the cattle that were coming down there, that he was never poisoned. So none of the charges against the Francher Party were ever proven, okay? All right. Well, what's happened since then? A couple of things. Yeah?
I was there the weekend that they put up the church put up the new signage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it was, as you walked around there, they had new ones. And by every sign, there was a somebody from the church historian's office or media or somebody just sitting there. And they were just writing down the comments that people, because quite a crowd there, the comments people made as they read the signage.
Yeah.
And because it was quite different.
That would be very cool.
And I was with a couple, and she was from Logandale in that area, in Nevada. And as she walked around, her husband asked her, he said, "Are you okay, Mel?" Because she'd gotten quieter and quieter. And
You do.
And she said, "It will be."
Wow.
But it was a real shock to her. Now, he and I had both read The Massacre at Meadow Mountain. We both read that.
Rick Turley's first book.
So we were relatively prepared for that. But it wasn't at all.
Yeah. Yeah, just north. Yeah.
And it's only a few miles from there. I didn't realize that. But one afternoon, I had to get out of the hubbub of 15 people.
Let's go someplace fun. Let's go down to Mountain Meadows.
First highway I came to.
Yeah.
And then I see the sign for the mountain.
Yeah.
I realized it was here. And so I went over there. So there were a number of people milling around. But as I got out and I walked down that area, it was such an oppressive feeling.
Oh, it's horrible. So, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to explain, but there's a spirit there that
it's a brooding where innocent innocent blood was shed. Yeah. It was kind of an on and off kind of thing. They'd had some battles early on. But by and large, Brigham Young had been pretty good about saying, let's feed the Indians after the first few little skirmishes. So it was not bad. It just depended on which tribe and which chief wanted to kind of take on the Mormons and which land we were recovering. But at that point, especially with the Paiutes down there, it was pretty amicable, and they fed them on a regular basis. Yeah. Throw them under the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they sort of did. It is yucky. Yeah, they were.
I was going to say, this is one of the first things that my family from Arkansas, that are not members, as we're getting back into our relationship, they brought that up. Explain that to us.
Yeah.
That's what. Still, at this point,
it still
time,
sits.
Still, because and being from that area, you don't forget it.
No.
It's one of those things that carries with you forever once you step on it.
Yeah. Well, so here's what's happened since then. When we rededicated those things, President Irene came down. And here's basically what he said. May the God of heaven, whose sons and daughters we are, bless us to honor those who died here by extending to one another the pure love and spirit of forgiveness which only his begotten Son personified. What was done here long ago by members of our church represents a terrible and inexcusable departure from Christian teaching and conduct. We cannot change what happened, but we can remember and honor those who were killed here. Many of those who carried out the massacre, and this is an aspect sometimes we don't think about, many of those who carried out the massacre were haunted all their lives by what they did and saw on that unforgettable day. They and their relatives have also suffered under a heavy burden of guilt. No doubt, divine justice will impose appropriate. But think about all of these members of the militia as well that had to live with what they did. I think they've identified in the book. I think it's like 80, something like that, and they're able to have. Yeah. They're hard. I've read several books. I'm just, yeah. Oh, it was horrific. Yeah, it's big. No, the scale of this was really bad. Something smaller. Yeah. 100. Who were then killed execution style after they've been. Had their arms taken away. Yeah, it wasn't even that.
I was always in the vision. It was kind of a running gun battle.
Yeah.
They disarmed the group and stood around them and said, okay, boys, let's do what we came for.
They're marching them in a line. Yeah, and everybody did that. So that's why I say they're just. The more you dig into it, the worse it gets.
That's about as bad as it gets.
Right? It's as bad as it gets. Yeah. Bad as you think it might be. Yeah.
It was. But the church and the government were pretty much the one thing back then. So I envisioned it more like the Elvis Horn president saying, hey,
there was a state president.
It was a state president who was also the lieutenant colonel of the militia. It had a military thing, so they were called out to go out to Mountain Meadows by the military leaders. Who were also their state presidents and bishops.
They believed they were doing
they did.
The right thing.
That's right. So that's the struggle that says until that moment, I think the vast majority of the militia didn't know until the last moment that says, okay, we're going to take their guns away from them. We're going to march them out here and then on a signal, shoot them.
I don't think they believed they were doing
that. I don't think that, yeah. And
they
so
they were doing the thing that would cover.
I think the leaders believe that, but I think our average guy didn't know and then had to make a decision. I mean, there are a number that says, yeah, I shot in the air. I couldn't do that, but I'm soldier, and these guys are coming for your families. So the rhetoric is there, and it's horrible. Yeah.
They all, anyway, I disagree with this thing. They did it because they thought it was good.
They'd been ordered. They were. That's why I say it's that the militia is called out. If you read the meetings of what was the meeting of the militia where they actually were sent out there, they didn't know completely what was going to go on, but when they get on the ground, they're given more details. We're just calling out to defend what's going on, what's happened out here.
We have to remember the heat that you just talked about. We're going to cover the temple. We're going to burn everything. We're going to live in the hills and be vigilantes. And that spirit was there.
Oh, sure.
And they thought, well, this. We're going to join into it.
There was a lot of
emotional.
Big. When again, remember, these are survivors of Hans Mill. There were survivors of Hans. This is going to happen again. But even then, I don't think even in their wildest dreams they might have thought they were going out to a gun battle, and we're going to be shooting at each other. I think the vast majority didn't realize what they were going to be called upon to do, and then they had to make a decision right at that moment.
It's amazing what people will do. Somebody to take responsibility.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and
we're all below what we think is right. If somebody's told us what we think is an authority, and they will take responsibility.
Yeah, that's true.
And the account I read was that initially they sent Indians terrorizing the Indians were led to but instead the Francis Tiger party.
That was John D. Lee's defense. The Indians have killed some and we can't settle them down.
Right.
It's not true.
It's not true.
That's his story. That's why I say within the last couple of years, additional research has said this was just a cattle raid. They came in and we have three other cattle raids, one happening farther south, two happening farther north, where they ride in, scatter the cattle, and ride away without any kind of... And they started to do that with these guys. These guys circled up, and now we're under siege. But there were very, very few Indians there This was all militia.
Is it possible that most of the participants believed or had heard the story about the poisoning?
John D. Lee might have said something like, and I think some of the rhetoric that comes out of that that says, well, somebody's got a gun that was used at Carthage, you know. So I think there might have been some rhetoric from John D. Lee, who, by the way, John D. Lee, as you may or may not know, is the only one that is actually brought to justice for this. And he's actually executed by firing squad at Mountain Meadows in front of his casket.
It fell
right into his casket, and he says, okay, keep it clean, boys. Don't mess up my clothes or something like that, okay? Yeah. 20. Yeah, it's 20 years. It's 1874. And they have to go down to Lee's Crossing to go capture him down there by Glen Canyon Dam. There's a long story behind that, and most of the second book that Turley and Brown write is about the aftermath of what it take to brought him to justice. They've actually been able to go through and transcribe the transcripts from the trials, and there's a lot of reasons behind that. Part of it is that the leaders, Danes and Klingensmith and others, leave, and they're on the lam. They're never really found and captured. Part of it was the leaders that were trying to convict Lee really wanted to get to Brigham Young. They really believed that Brigham Young had, they hated Brigham Young. They wanted Brigham Young. So they're waiting and waiting, and Lee gets caught up in this, in the fact that, think about every cop show you've ever seen where you have like a gang or something like that. So you get one of the little fish and you want him to turn evidence on the big fish. So they capture John D. Lee, who had been some of the more outspoken guy. They capture him and they say, if you'll give us the goods, good confession that'll help us get to Brigham Young, you might be able to even get off on this. So he spills his guts. They really don't like his confession that much, and so they're going to hold him to it because they're still trying to get to Brigham Young. And they keep dragging this thing. We get through the Civil War. We get all this kind of stuff. And by the time they think that they're going to get to him, Brigham Young dies. And now they'll go after polygamy instead of Mountain Meadows. That's why.
Well, I sound silly, but knowing that this happened just a few years, and I know, you know, these people remember the thing that happened in Honolulu and everything. That's why they're where they're at.
Part of where that fervor came from.
In the Book of Mormon, I remember reading that, you know, there was the tribes and God gave them the right to defend their homes and their freedom because they had been, under slavery and stuff. So they said that as long as, you know, you're defending your home and you're defending your religion and your freedom, that was fine. And this is what they were doing, because if this got out that it was the Mormons that were doing this and not the Indians.
That was the motivation. That had some bearing on what do we need to do. And had they been attacked, let's say that the Francher party had all rode into town firing rifles and stuff like that, maybe a little bit more. But the way that they did it and the reasons they did it and how they did it is there's no justification, period.
They were protecting their...
They thought they were. They weren't being attacked, and they could have said, the boy was killed by mistake and we are so sorry, and they could have tried to make amends for that. But rather than do that, we'll kill 120 people.
The leaders were participating in a cover-up.
Very much. That's probably a really good way to put it, yeah.
We don't know if it's true, but they believe that they were boasting that they had.
Not true. It's not true. It's one of the lies that John D. Lee perpetrated. There was a number of things that had gone for years trying to say, and there's no record of any of that being said. Yeah.
Whenever any organization tries to protect the
Yeah. Yeah, the result is never good. Yeah. Okay, so here's the the ones we don't know about. Okay, so here's the things that have happened since then. What's happened in the meantime? Rick Turley and Barbara Brown have been very extensive in not just writing the books, but speaking about it and speaking at Francher Party, Francher family reunions, and have worked very hard at bringing together the descendants of the perpetrators and the descendants of those that were killed. And there has been quite an organization of both groups coming together. They have created two massive quilts that have the names, but were a joint effort by the perpetrators and victims, ancestors or descendants. They continued to meet together. They had a meeting about 2 years ago in the tabernacle with Turley and Brown speaking. And they said that they had a lot of people there in the tabernacle. And towards the end of it, they said, and by the way, we have two families here that are descendants of the victims of the French party. And they stood up and got a standing ovation, basically, in the tabernacle. And then one of the gentlemen came to Barbara later on and said, thanks for that. It took me hours to get out of the tabernacle. He said there was this long line of people that just coming sometimes in tears and just hugging us and saying, we are so sorry. I can't believe this happened. And he says that spirit of reconciliation and love has just continued to happen over and over. And so they had even just, I think 2 years ago, they found a skull that had been previously not buried, and they held a reburial of a child, and the families returned for the burial. So
what kind of monument?
A lot.
It
used to be. You've seen it's been about 10 years since I've been there. Whoops. Let's see. Well, hold on here. Let's see. That. Yeah. Oops. That. When I went, that was really the only. You could go on here, go up over a rise that would show you an overlook where the massacre actually took place. But they've now, I think they've now replaced that with a lot more extensive. Yeah, it does. There's like the Vietnam Memorial thing.
When I was there, there was the rock in the center.
Yeah.
There was a stone wall, the whole site, and it had the name.
Yeah. This is actually built where the wagon train had circled up. The actual massacre is down a hill and comes around over here. And you can stand on a hill and overlook that rise. Yeah, they were put in really shallow graves. The army did. Worse and worser and worser. Absolutely, and that's where they became aware of it. So this became national headlines. And if they had just handled it at the time and recognized that a boy had been killed and dealt with that, it may be a different story, but it got worser and worser.
What they needed to recognize the error and execute the guy who shot
them. Well, they could do that.
Why didn't they wait until the
They felt like it was too, well, between now and then the boy was shot. And now our die is cast. We got to, that again, that was the thing where they said, oh my gosh, now we've shed blood and they're going to tell them that we're shooting people and they know it's they know it's white people. So that's why they went ahead and executed. It just goes and goes, doesn't it? Yeah, we have their writings. We have the discussion, because when John D. Lee goes back and he tells William Dames, who is the lieutenant colonel of the militia, and they bring in Klingon Smith, who is he's like the next down. That was their discussion. And it was William Dames that's pushing it more, saying they're gonna bring an army from the south. We gotta use them up. No, just the opposite. Yeah. In other words, we're going to go, because again, when Van Fleet arrives back in and he meets with the army, your average army guy is like, no, we're anxious to go to, we're going to kill him. We're going to take him out. They're a blight. They're a blight on society. Brigham Young is out of control. We're going to kill Brigham Young. They were really, they were close to a mob. Yeah. They had become a little less religious just because they were so busy trying to live and build their houses. And
how religious were they at this point? Depart so much from.
Yeah. I know that's why there is a question always hanging in the air. I know when I read the first book by Juanita Brooks, who was a descendant of John D. Lee. That was my question. How could Latter-day Saints have done this? And it's always a question. I know that years ago they did and you guys might have heard, in Psychology 101, you always hear about kind of the Hitler experiment at Stanford that they did before they had ethics courses on how you do research, where they had the guy in an actor in one room, and then they had a kid sitting at a switch in another room, and he's being told, you're going to supply a shock and you'll hear him on the other side, but it's okay. But if you do it all the way up there, it could be fatal, but it's okay. Okay. And so they start to move it on one side, and the actor on the other side would go, oh, ow, oh, okay. No, that's all right. And then they would just say, it can be a little bit more, and it can be a little more, and then having the instructor then say, now it's all right to go ahead and put it in the red zone. Well, won't that kill? No, it's all right. We've signed off on this. They know it's okay. And they were surprised. The majority of the kids sitting in there actually moved the dial to the red zone.
Some didn't, but most did.
Most
did.
It was
that's where my comment.
Yes.
If somebody else would take responsibility,
it could. And that's where kind of mob mentality takes over, where you would do some things. But even if it's individual, like, you're under orders to do this, then your average soldier might have just said, I wouldn't ever do this on my own, but at the spur of the moment, being ordered to do this, would I do it? That might have been it. But that's why I think President Irene is touched on an important nerve. Because I'll say this. Juanita Brooks, who, again, descendant, she writes the first book. And she doesn't have access to a lot of the information. But Juanita writes the books. Her ancestor was John D. Lee. She becomes interested because she finds out that her patriarch was at Mountain Meadows. Oops. Yeah. So for that generation that had to live with what they did and then take individual responsibility for what level at which they participated, had to be just the worst, because if they're going to be sitting in sacrament meeting and deciding whether they take the sacrament or they build a temple in St. George, are we going to go, what do you do with all of that? And at what point, especially if you're one of those that didn't shoot over the head, you're one of those that actually participated, then they've got an individual struggle that they've got to deal with.
I was going to say, that's kind of what happened to my dad when we joined the church during World War II, that once some of the guys in our ward found out he was a vet from World War II, it was
or returning from Vietnam, where everybody was baby killers. And I would imagine.
And that was a war that you didn't talk about.
No, and they didn't talk about it, didn't they?
I mean, when he started to go to group, he was 70 years old.
Wow.
And that screwed him up even more.
Because now let's talk about it. Let's talk about the things that you've never talked about.
Start beating my mother at night because, you know, we're thinking something's happening.
And we're having flashbacks.
It wasn't beating her, he was thrashing.
I think it's a good point. Yeah, we need the spirituality vertical, but we also need religion horizontal, community. We need both. Yeah. And that enters in. Yeah, like I said, I think that was part of it, yeah.
When I was 11, and my uncle
a nuclear physicist. You're going to nuke people. Peacemaking and how to, yes.
Isn't that what that is, basically?
I think, and it's a struggle that it's a struggle that we have, yeah. Right?
One thought that I would make is, compare Reading Young, Reading Young would often blow a little steam.
Yeah.
Then he would come back and say, okay, now.
Yeah.
Let's listen to what the Lord has to say.
Right. No.
And the thing that impresses me is,
and you don't react out of an emotional response. Yeah, Travis?
We started off talking about the Utah War. This was not the end of the Utah War. You haven't told us how it ended.
Oh, I didn't, did I? Actually, that was it. it was.
And so I did take a church history class at BYU.
Yeah.
The professor said that looking at hindsight in the Utah War, we realized that the army was in the valley for 3 years.
Yeah, before they went back to the Civil War.
It actually turned out that was a benefit to the saints.
Big time.
Because at that
time,
we talked about the isolation of the saints. They were living in their own community. It had become a U.S. territory, and at the time, they were poor. They were trying to survive. With having the U.S. Army in the valley for 3 years, the U.S. government was pouring in U.S. dollars into the valley. It brought the saints back into the U.S. company with the U.S. dollar. So they then had U.S. dollars to buy things with. So when the train came through, you know, the railroad came through, they had dollars to buy things and bring to the West. So in the long run, having the army there for 3 years
helped quite a bit.
U.S. dollars into their economy brought the same
a lot of prosperity
into the United States.
By the way, you know the funny part too that I find curious is that they land at Camp Floyd. They build out at Camp Floyd right there where the Jordan River is crossing up there. Do you know who owned the land right next to them in Lehigh and Point of the Mountain? Whose original land that was? Porter Rockwell. Of all people, it would be Porter Rockwell that owned that land right there. Yeah.
At the very beginning,
Yes. That's why I wanted to lead with that.
Yeah. One way I can understand that is on my mission, my responsibility to save the people in that area. And my companion wasn't bad, but he just wasn't valiant. And we were teaching a family, and if he became more valiant, we would get a baptism.
That's right.
That made him feel like he was a terrible, evil person.
Yeah.
But it was out of my belief that I was being
I think we're capable of it.
Thing.
Yeah.
I still wish I could go there.
You still shudder about that.
Well, I apologize to him. I'm sorry. I made you feel that way. I think they... That overzealousness
is partially. There is no question about it. No question about it. Okay, last comment and then we'll finish up here.
This thing about going to somebody to apologize, I just want to say that it took me 3 or 4 hours to find the kid that I hurt in third grade. And I didn't go to him, but I called him and apologized. And it took me a couple hours to find the guy that ran over me when I was 7 years old. I called him when he was 70, told him it wasn't his fault. So you can find these people.
Yeah, I know. But there are going to be some things, I think that's why this is the kind of thing, I think the church is really, and those associated with all of this, have really tried to go out of their way to say, we're not trying to justify, we're not trying to explain, we're not trying to rationalize, we're just saying it was straight up wrong and anything we can do, we'll do. And I love that the church is doing that, Brent.
My grandfather was a missionary.
Oh. Oh.
Met many of the neighbors and relatives. Stayed in their homes at night.
Wow.
He did not know it at the time. But almost every one of those folks were there. I suspect those who committed the relatives of those who shot.
Yeah. Could be. How we doing? You know, I hesitated a little bit. We'll finish with this. Last week's lesson on priesthood and stuff like that, so uplifting. And then we have these moments, you know, where you just go, your heart just aches. And church history is filled with roller coaster things of we have the gospel, and then we have the church, and in all of its strengths and weaknesses of its leaders and strengths and weaknesses of the people. And then surrounding that, then we have the culture. And our church culture and traditions and beliefs and stuff form so much of that. And trying to make sure that we always balance that we get a chance to worship the Savior and Jesus Christ. And by and large, the church does so many good things. But by and large, the church is made up of people that sometimes err. And we weep for those times when maybe things don't go well, or a bishop didn't say the right thing, or kids got ostracized, or somebody got judged out of Relief Society or something. Okay, but at the end of the day, if we see mortality in that bigger picture, it's one of those reasons why we cling to the Savior and we cling to Jesus Christ and try and do the right thing by Him. So.
Lion Art.
had been raised Mormon but was not practicing, told, had us all read before we started a book called about tribal art, and it explained so much to me about how people act in tribe culture.
Yeah, and cultural wise, right?
As part of the culture, and they feel like they have to because the culture is threatened. It was a very, very informative.
Can be, yeah.
It taught me a lot about our family.
Well, and that's kind of the idea, isn't it, that we learn from it. Okay. All right. Whew. Heavy class, big class. Thank you guys for hanging in there. So again, before next week, if you want to, any part of church history that you still have some questions about, some of this we could continue if you still have some questions, but just shoot me a text. Okay. Cindy, could we call on you for a closing prayer?
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.